Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, does ChatGPT get sad? Is Claude bored of answering my inane questions? Could AI be conscious? We'll be assembling a crack team of scientists and philosophers to discuss. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We'll get to all of your comments at the end of the pod. But before that, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Matt Campbell, Professor of Genetics and Head of Department at the Smurfit Institute of Genetics in Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Laura Hayes, Assistant Professor at Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do, Matt, with eye implants.
Yeah, so this is a really exciting study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine. So some of the biggest findings in medicine are published in this journal. You know, you need to have a breakthrough in medicine to actually get into this journal. And it was a device called the Prima device. It's just been approved in Europe for use in a condition called geographic atrophy. So you mightn't have heard of geographic atrophy, but what you probably will have heard of is age-related macular degeneration, or AMD for short. So most people, you know, if you've got parents in their late 70s or 80s, or friends in that old, about one in two people over the age of 90 will have this condition. And the end stage of AMD, one of the end stages is called geographic atrophy, where the pigment that the retina sits on begins to degenerate. When that happens, the retina will degenerate. And when the macula degenerates, the very, very center of the retina, you'll lose your vision. So what this Prima device was, it was a subretinal implant. So basically, the ophthalmic surgeons would make a tiny little detachment in the center of the retina and place this device. It was a small electrode, a photosensitive electrode. It was 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters, so absolutely tiny, and they place it in the very center of the retina, in the macula. Okay, what they then did was they'd let it settle down for a couple of months, and the patients would then be equipped with a set of reading glasses that would have a camera that would illuminate the outside world. The information from that camera would come back into a probe that would be held in the patient's pocket that would then send a signal back into the glasses and illuminate the back of the eye using infrared and give signals to the electrode that would then send images down the optic nerve to the brain. So patients who essentially were almost completely blind were getting lines on a chart. They were able to see lines on a chart again. So it was almost curative, you know, for patients who were end stage. Now, I must caution that this wasn't, if you look at the paper and scratch the surface of it, it's not perfect vision they get.
Okay? Yeah, so let's just break down a little bit of what you've said there. So essentially what they have is a relay system.
Yep.
where this electronic device in their eye is, the glasses are seeing the world. It's going from the glasses into their pocket, back out, and relayed through the system into the eye. And then that eye is stimulating the optical nerve to say, this is the picture that you should be seeing.
Exactly. So you've got to think
about
the retina is part of the brain. So this basically is a brain-computer interface, similar to what Neuralink is. It's just that the input is light. So because the retina is part of your brain, the stimulus is light. And what these patients were lacking was the cells that create the little electrical activity that then send the signal back to the brain. So what this chip is doing is it basically is bypassing that. The light is being converted into energy, electricity, from the microchip, which is then relaying the signal back towards the optic nerve and back to the brain. So it's absolutely incredible. And it has been approved. Now, the caveat here is that it's not for all patients with geographic atrophy, because it is time consuming to put these chips in. If you look at the paper, there are adverse events. So some of the patients had hemorrhages during the placement of these chips. So it's not a quick fix, but it's absolutely amazing that we can now do this.
And of course, it will only get better. But as you said, it doesn't cure their vision. So 20/20 is perfect length vision, and 20/200 is blind, profound blindness.
Exactly.
And so this restores them to sort of 20/160. But they can actually, as you say, they can read charts. They would be able to navigate a room.
So if you remember the charts, that when you're getting your glasses and you're asked to read a chart of all the letters, they'll get 5 lines extra on that chart.
That's incredible.
Which is incredible. It's absolutely
amazing. From blindness. Yeah.
So, you know, this is complete blindness that some of these patients have, that they're getting some restoration of that vision.
And because they're blind, do we know from the paper that when they look, does it feel like real vision, or does it feel something different? Because of course they're not getting natural wavelengths from the natural world. They're getting, you know, information from a diode.
So for some of the patients, they followed these patients up for 4 years. Okay, so it was a longitudinal study. And in a subset of patients, they did really well. Because you've got to remember that, you're exactly to your point, that the vision isn't the same as what they had. It's kind of like a magnified version of the vision that you have. When you're reading each individual word as you see it, as opposed to when we read, just predicting what's coming next. So, you know, the patients do have to learn how to use this, but absolutely fascinating.
Very cool. Laura, our second study has to do with Saturn.
It does indeed. Right, so we think about our own moon, we have one moon, but Saturn and Jupiter, which are these big gas giants out in our solar system, have hundreds of moons, right? And we look at Jupiter, Jupiter has four large moons, right? So it has, you know, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, Ganymede being the largest moon in our solar system, moons the size of kind of maybe like Mercury. And Saturn is quite similar to Jupiter, but it only has one large moon, right? So it has hundreds of small moons, but only one large moon. And this is a big question. If you have these two gas giants, very similar, why does Jupiter have these four massive moons and Saturn only have one? This is kind of an open question that, you know, scientists have been thinking about. And what this study has done, this is a study published this week in Nature Astronomy from researchers in Japan and Kyoto. And they looked at a very large computer simulation of trying to go back in time and trying to model what these gas giants were like at the early stages of the solar system. So you kind of had, if you think of the solar system forming, the sun maybe was forming a lot of the mass in the center of the solar system. But out there, we had these two gas giants formed and then themselves almost acted like little solar systems. They have this kind of like circumplanetary disk, kind of like a little solar system. And as it was really hot and really magnetized, these basically moons were starting to form in this gas around these planets. So they went back in this time, did this big simulation and tried to see, well, what was different between how these two planets were forming? Did it impact how these moons were formed? Mm. And the answer is it all comes down to the magnetic field. So it seems like early in the universe, Jupiter had a much stronger magnetic field. And what that did, it actually kind of basically made a blocker just away from the surface of Jupiter. So that as these moons were forming, what happened is the moons were forming and kind of gravitating towards the planets. But Jupiter had this blocker due to the large magnetic field, basically like a barrier. So these moons kind of stopped and didn't basically fall into the planet. And unlike Jupiter, Saturn, unfortunately, didn't have this very strong magnetic field. And hence, we only have one large moon really far out, which is Titan, which is the second biggest moon in our solar system. So basically what they think is maybe Saturn actually did create all these moons, but basically they just all fell in and died.
So Saturn could be like a... like a turducken or something.
Yeah.
You know, like it might have like four different meats in one moon, because it may be the conglomeration of lots of different mini moons over time.
Well, kind of, right. So the one moon that did actually survive was way further out. And it was kind of like a rocky and out past the safe zone of falling in. But what they think is the moons that would have fallen in, it didn't explicitly show this in the paper, but they kind of pointed at it, like the rings of Saturn, icy moons that kind of collided. And basically what you have is this large kind of dust, icy field surrounding Saturn, where it kind of gives it its rings. So that's a possible solution of why maybe Saturn has these rings.
People of a certain generation explaining to people of an other generation what turducken is right now. Matt, our third story is really, really interesting. It's about stopping cavities.
Yeah, it's a super interesting study. It's just come out of the University of Michigan. It's a big phase three clinical trial. And when I started reading this paper, one fact that jumped out to me, which was incredible, is, and it's a question I can ask you as well, is what is the most common chronic disease in children under the age of 12? In the US, let's talk US.
I have no idea.
So tooth decay. I would have thought asthma or obesity or something like that, but tooth decay is actually five times more common in children in the US than asthma. And it's a real problem, especially for some people who live below a certain socioeconomic level in the US, you know, who can't afford dental care. So there is a solution that's been used for years. This isn't brand new, you know, this solution's been about. It's called SDF or silver diamine fluoride. And it's a solution that sometimes dentists will apply to a cavity in children who mightn't be cooperative. They mightn't be able to sit still, or maybe kids who have special needs who won't be amenable to have cavities, you know, cleaned out and having fillings placed. So dentists have used this off-label for the past 12 to 15 years. So that means basically it's not an approved material that is licensed for use, but clinicians are allowed to use these things off-label.
I'm asking a question maybe outside of your domain, but this isn't what dentists call a Fisher seal, is it? Is that what they use for Fisher
this
seals?
Is slightly different from that. So it's different from Fisher seal. This will be exclusively used for cavities that have a specific, you know, a concept that the cavities are either, you know, the child can't sit still to have them removed. So it's kind of a fail-safe. What it does basically is it's applied with a small sponge. And as I said, it's been used off-label. But this study from the University of Michigan was a phase three trial of 830 kids, where they basically made their hypotheses and they made their statements of this is how it's going to work. And what they discovered was that these children under the age of 11 who had this applied, in that about 50% of the patients, they actually responded very well to it. And they had a decrease in pain. They were able to better manage it. They had increased number of school hours they were able to attend. Because obviously with this tooth decay comes lots of sequelae, you know, issues of kids dropping out of school, not being able to go to school, lack of sleep, etc., behavioral problems and pain. So what the conclusions of the study were is that this likely will get FDA approval now because the numbers were sufficient, the project was sufficiently powered and the effects were sufficiently robust that this material, SDF, will likely be approved for use in the US, which is incredible. Mm. Because there are certain types of patients, as I mentioned, that aren't amenable to you know, sitting still for long periods of time. There are also individuals who just simply can't afford to have fill-ins done.
Yeah.
A lot of kids as well might be getting to a point where these are baby teeth, you know, so you only need a small period of time just to get the tooth stable over some time before you actually have the fill-in done. So. Yeah.
It's great, and it's rare that, you know, it's rare that something that's off-label eventually becomes on-label for something, but it could be hugely beneficial, particularly in a country where a lot of the states refuse to put fluoride in the water, despite the fact that it's one of the most effective.
And a major caveat is that it does leave black marks on the tooth, so this isn't, it's not a fix-all.
It does
stay in the tooth long-term, but it's a nice study.
Laura, our final piece is on dreams.
It is indeed. And this really caught my eye because I am someone that always has very vivid dreams and always thinking about my dreams and what do they mean. And this was a study that was done in Lucca in Italy and published in Communication Psychology, where they went and studied a huge population of people and tried to get them to record their dreams and compare, you know, record their dreams and then also record their waking thoughts over a 2-week period. So they recorded over, you know, 3,000 matched dream and waking reports. And what they did is try to understand, you know, what is the relationship between your dreams and your daily life and your emotional responses and things like this. And what they found is maybe not so surprising, right, in some sense. They found that, you know, your waking thoughts are more like your internal monologue, and then dreaming is more like being immersed in a film. Right. And if you think about if you have vivid dreams, but that's kind of maybe clear to those of us who do. And what they did is basically every morning they asked participants to wake up and then voice record what their dream was as soon as they could remember. And then for those days, they get a random text message in the middle of the day when they're waking and say, hey, what are you thinking about right now? And they'd record this. And basically what they found is compared to waking thoughts, dreams are more visual, spatial, social and bizarre than waking thoughts. And dreamers had less control, while waking reports kind of had more reasoning and awareness of time. And I think this is kind of interesting that...
I mean, does that say anything really? Don't we know that?
Yeah. I guess this is a thing. And, you know, maybe this isn't that surprising. But what is really interesting is how they did this study, right? So they, you know, doing the study is very hard because if you get a report of what was your dream like, you have to get someone to go and read it and then interpret what that meant. But now we live in a world of natural language processing and LLMs. So what this study actually did is use an NLP, so natural language processing, to kind of process all these dreams and do things of understanding, you know, emotions in your dreams versus emotions in your waking thoughts. So basically semantic structure that can be done and ideas and words and concepts and how they're connected through this piece of language. And this is, I think, a really interesting way to kind of move forward and think about this. And, you know, those are kind of basic things, you know, dreams are more mad than general life. But they found kind of relationships between people who were more kind of mind-wandering when they're awake also had more vivid dreams.
Hmm.
But the most important, or not most important, but most interesting thing in this study is actually they also had a period of time where they did this over COVID. Right, so they have a kind of metric of or observations of people over COVID, and those dreams, maybe not surprising, during lockdown, these dreams contained restrictions and emotional intensity, but didn't really actually have dreams about the virus itself or being in a hospital. It was more being locked in and more intense emotional. But what they found is that they could actually track that those intensity and emotions changed as the COVID lockdown opened, and they see that now, you know, we've actually kind of reversed. So it's kind of showing that, you know, a shared event can have emotional structure in the population of people's dreams.
Yeah, very cool. When you say vivid dreams, do you have a recurring dream?
I do have a recurring dream, which is actually very funny, right? Because I'm an astrophysicist. I actually have a recurring nightmare, I would say, that I wake up in my dream and I'm being launched into space and I do not want to go to space.
Oh.
And which is
first astrophysicist I've ever met in my life who doesn't want to go to space.
Yeah.
What kind of astrophysicist are you?
I know.
My recurring dream is always that something has happened and as a result I have to go rogue and leave my entire life behind me and I'm always okay with it.
Oh, okay.
My entire life, my family, everything. I'm like, yep, well, that's that. Toss the match and burn and go. I don't know why that is. Matt?
My dreams were very impacted by getting a dog, actually, and, you know, having the dog barking nonstop. So my dreams were heavily impacted by that when we got a dog a few years ago. I tend to not dream very much during working hours. When I go on holidays, I have the wackiest dreams, and I'd be afraid to tell you what I dream about. So.
Okay. Well, yeah, you've left it up to our imagination, which are probably way worse. Matt Campbell and Laura Hayes, thank you very much. On the way, we have a team of a neuroscientist, an AI expert, and a philosopher try and answer a question that we're all thinking. Can AI really be conscious? Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Brief on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. So this kind of idea has been tossed around quite a lot over the last number of years and before that, decades and possibly even centuries. But it's time we kind of talked about it in detail on Future Proof, I think, because we're seeing so many headlines that are hinting towards the consciousness of AI. And we really wanted to examine what exactly do these claims mean and whether or not there's anything to them at all. So in February, Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei went on a podcast and he said his company couldn't rule out the possibility that one of their models, by chance, was conscious. Philosopher David Chalmers, who coined the phrase the hard problem of consciousness, has said himself he believes there's a significant chance of conscious LLMs within a decade. But the conversation around AI has always been sort of half a balance of hype and half a balance of fantasy. And so today we're going to try and explore what the AI is doing, what it is capable of now and in the future, and whether or not we could at any point call what it does something akin to being conscious. Joining me to discuss these are a fantastic panel. Charlotte Blees, philosopher at Uppsala University and author of Dr. Bot, Why Doctors Can Fail Us and How AI Could Save Lives. Associate Professor of Genetics and Neuroscience at Trinity College Dublin and author of Free Agents, How Evolution Gave Us Free Will, Kevin Mitchell. And Professor of Computing at DCU, Alan Smeaton, who also have a lot of other titles within the world of AI. He's one of the more foremost thinkers in the subject. So I wanted to bring together a philosopher, a neuroscientist and an AI person, because there are lots of different aspects to this, right? So, Kevin, because the question is consciousness, let's talk very briefly about what we could possibly mean by this term when it comes to a machine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tricky thing. Judging whether an AI is conscious, you'd have to have some good concept of what consciousness is already in your mind. And we don't. We have lots of different concepts, and it refers to lots of different things. And partly that's what's tricky about the science of it, because, you know, you could think of consciousness as just sentience. What does it take to be aware of things in your surroundings and responding to them? Well, like a self-driving car does that. A thermostat is, in a sense, sensing things in the environment and responding. Mm. So that's not a really good criterion. You can think, you know, just basically, what does it mean to be awake? Like, what's the difference between being conscious and unconscious? What does anesthesia do? And people can study that.
Again, but not really clear on that.
Not very well understood at all. But I think what people really are getting at here is not just that there's something going on internally, there's some reasoning maybe going on internally, which these LLMs are maybe doing, but that it feels like something. Mm. They're having an experience of that. It feels like something to be Claude or ChatGPT or a self-driving car or a drone or whatever it happens to be. And that is really, really difficult to know scientifically even how to think about it and define it. And, you know, people are trying in neuroscience to distinguish, for example, when we are aware of something visually presented and when we're not, right? And so that's a nice neural correlate of having a conscious experience, but it doesn't say why you're the type of thing that can have an experience in the first place.
Yeah.
So our theories of consciousness are a bit all over the place. And really, we don't have a good handle on it at all. It remains very mysterious.
Okay, that's not helpful, because this is the very first part. We can't even just start off by saying, well, okay, here's the checklist that we require. But there are things there that you've kind of listed, and maybe we might go into those in a bit more detail. What are your thoughts on this, Charlotte?
Yeah, so I don't know if philosophers can shed more light. They very often ask more questions or invite more questions, but certainly philosophers have been thinking about consciousness or what it is to have a mind for thousands of years. In the 17th century, John Locke talked about consciousness as the perception of what passes in one's mind. So this idea of awareness, But added to that, the subjectivity associated with it. So it's not just the feeling or the taste of something, but it's the awareness that one is experiencing this thing. So David Chalmers, as you said, described this as a particularly difficult problem. Why is it that some physical substrate of some sort has to have this sensory experience, if you like, or awareness on top of that? What is the relationship between the two? Other philosophers have sort of taken a deflationary perspective and said, so people like Patricia and Paul Churchland, American philosophers, have said that it's not really a problem. It's probably more an artifact of how our minds work, that we think of it as some sort of deeply mysterious problem, and that this will go by the wayside, a bit like the idea that there had to be a vital force associated with life. What was this added extra spirit component? And that we might actually have the same attitude. It's a bit, it's like work. We actually have to do the mechanistic work of understanding the configuration of matter that gives rise to or is it this particular phenomenon. But yeah, so but philosophers have come up with a whole variety of theories about the relationship between the mind and body.
Hmm. And is a general feeling that philosophers think that you need to be a human to be fully sentient of, or an animal to be fully sentient of?
No. So one particular theory is functionalism. So it's not specifically identifying a mental state with a physical state, so perhaps a neural state, but it's more something like the structure of that state. So in other words, it's the right configuration of that matters. So it's more like structure over or form over content in a certain sense that gives rise to consciousness. So that's functionalism. Mm. So the idea would be that you don't necessarily need cellular biology, but you could have silicon configured in a particular way that could give rise to multiple ways in which you could realize. Mm. But that's one particular theory.
So we're going to bring in Alan now, and I know Alan is going to be quite a skeptical voice on this, and that you're absolutely within your right to do it. But I want to phrase this question for you in a way that I know also Kevin disagrees with me. But I feel like we are a function of our environment and our genes, that there is a program that runs within us, and we do what we do as a result of all the things that have happened to us. And in this way, it's sort of like a computer program. And if we think that we as sentient beings came from pressure, temperature, rocks, that's where we came from, right? If we trace back where we all came from, we must have come from rocks, pressure, heat, and turned from inanimate, unsentient things into sentient things. Mm. My question is for you, can we not also attribute consciousness in a way to something that is not living, something like an AI?
Yeah, okay. So there's two parts that I'll use in address to that. One is that the reason why a lot of people, and I'd add Jeff Hinton to that list of people who are talking about chatbots having consciousness, the reason that is happening is that it is behaving, as Kevin says, as if it is a real person. It is my buddy. It is my friend.
Do you mean an example of an interaction for people who don't use chatbots? Why would someone think, God, this machine is thinking?
Because they ask for advice and it gives advice and it always gives you advice that you want to hear, and it sort of self-reinforces your beliefs. And it knows me. It knows me really well. It, right? And it's that anthropomorphization, which is a term that's been used with chatbots since ChatGPT happened three and a bit years ago. Mm. So because of that, it's a natural next step, right? We say that, you know, people will say that they are wise. They've got wisdom. They've got experience. They've got expertise. They've got consciousness. It's the natural sort of sequence of things, of anthropomorphizing and personalizing something. But to go back to the other element of your question, can anything be have consciousness? I think that the complexity of the human brain is so many orders of magnitude more complex than a large language model. I think that, and I'll defer to Kevin's wisdom on it, the biochemical processes that make up neurons that link together, the complexity of those, the structure of the human brain, the way that dendrites are arranged into hierarchical structures, and there's, you know, all of this stuff,
yeah,
right?
But whereas a language model... complexity is not the question.
Whereas a language model is just the same weights linking different nodes. And what has happened is that the human brain, or any other brain with consciousness, has evolved over millennia, whereas language models have just been thrown together. Right?
Okay, but I like complexity. We can't use complexity as a yardstick for sentience, I don't think. And I would also say that these LLMs have read every single book in the human language, in different languages.
Extracted the patterns.
Indeed, but they have taken the inverted commas knowledge from this, right? And they can give that knowledge out. As far as we can see it, Alan, right? Mm-hmm. When we ask a question about, Romeo mean when he said something in a Shakespeare, it can give us back something that looks and feels like a clever and intelligent response.
Because it has surfaced all of the patterns in its training data. And then the responses will seemingly be intelligent, but it will hallucinate. Right,
but humans hallucinate. So hallucinations aren't necessarily a factor that would disqualify sentience.
Correct. But again, I go back to the fact that all that they are doing is surfacing the patterns based on huge statistics and huge distributions. And those surfaced patterns have the apparent illusion of it being knowledge and intelligence.
Mm. You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk, where we're asking this big question that everyone seems to be talking about whether or not AI could potentially be conscious. We've got some heavyweights in the room, philosopher, an AI expert, and a neuroscientist. Kevin Mitchell, neuroscientist at Trinity College Dublin. What do you say to what Alan is saying there, that this is just weights and numbers? I mean, is our brain anything more than a fancy computer working off pre-programmed weights and so on?
Yeah, it's really interesting because we've heard basically three positions here. So Charlotte described the functionalism, not necessarily endorsing it, but describing it as a position where, you know, given a system that does the kind of operations and maybe that has the right kinds of relations with things in the world, that should be able to mount consciousness, to do consciousness as an activity, basically. Whereas I think Alan espoused something more like biological naturalism, which is there's something about the stuff, the gooey, wet stuff, or the complexity of the way that it's put together that's required. And I think, you know, I actually sympathize with your argument that complexity by itself is not a really good argument. It might be right now to say in practice the things we have right now are not complex enough or they're not organized the right way. But in theory or in principle, we could organize something the right way and put it in the world in such a way that it's having the right kinds of relations similar to what we do or an animal. And then it could have something to think about, right? The thing with LLMs at the moment is they're basically a brain in a vat. Mm-hmm. They're not connected to the world. They don't intervene on it. Their world model is just a world of words model. And it's incredibly powerful. And they can do causal reasoning over it and extract things and respond intelligently, apparently, as you said. I mean, it's amazing, right? But if you want to ask, okay, but what could they be conscious of? Is it just internal intellectual thoughts that are not grounded to anything? They don't know what a rose smells like, right? They don't know what it looks like. They just know the word is connected to these other words. So I think what's really interesting is the prospect of actually taking those kinds of systems and embodying them, like putting them in a robot. And people are doing this, putting them in a robot. Now the robot it's able to sense things in the environment. It's able to act on the environment and extract causal information from its own experience and build that up. But it also can do all this fancy reasoning. And then we're getting closer to something that seems like it should be experiencing the world. Like, why wouldn't it be? And this, I think, is ultimately, you know, what you were getting at, which is I think an argument or expression of naturalism, which is to say, look, if we came by our consciousness without any magic, without anything supernatural, then by extension, in principle, we should be able to recapitulate whatever that organization is in some other kind of system.
And evolution took millions and millions of years.
Exactly.
We don't have that, but is this the beginning of something?
Oh. Yeah, and that some other system, Kevin. You know, about 3 or 4 years ago, I thought that the emergence of large language models, mm-hmm. as opposed to the small large language models that we were playing with before ChatGPT, I thought this was a golden opportunity for neuroscience. Yeah. Whereas you work by probing the brain with all the basic technologies that you have, EEG and fMRI, and all those kind of things, and you're looking for what parts would light up, etc. I thought this is a great to have a digital sandpit where you can model the human brain. And I think now that was a bit naive to think of that 2 or 3 years ago, because what has happened since is that sandpit has been hijacked by big tech and AI companies, and it's gone off in other directions. And the only ones of those AI companies which are doing anything to explore the science of why they work the way they work is Anthropic.
Yeah.
The others just don't care because everybody's function is focused on deployment of models.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that the LLMs just aren't designed with the architecture that the human brain has. And they're also not designed to be conscious, right? Mm. That's not their job. And to expect it to just kind of pop out of them is a bit unrealistic. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you couldn't design something that
exactly.
Could. Philosopher Charlotte?
So,
I'm only calling you that as a weird thing to say, but just because people are listening.
You're very welcome.
Philosopher Charlotte.
So Alan picked up on the point about anthropomorphism, which is the idea, and another philosopher, Daniel Dennett, focused on this a lot too, this idea of we adopt what he called the intentional stance, meaning that we tend to impute that there's beliefs and desires to all kinds of artifacts and phenomena in our environment. People tend to wallop the printer that doesn't work and curse it, smoke alarms and all kinds of things. But I think what there's a really serious point here about large language models because of the rapidity of the responses, the fluency of the responses, and how compelling they are mean that we really do tend to anthropomorphize these devices. And that might be the bigger risk right now than them thinking about them having consciousness as we know it, that we tend to sort of view them in our own image. That's very seductive. But I would sort of, to get to the point of are machines currently, or large language models currently conscious, I agree with Kevin. It's more a case of that they've got to be sort of multimodal, they've got to be embodied in some sense in an environment. I remain agnostic about whether that's entirely possible. But the bigger threat may be that these machines can be highly capable. They don't need to hate us. They don't need to have the same evolved motivations like lust and violent tendencies and all the other things. There can be unintended serious consequences with the capabilities of these devices that mean that they are a threat in all kinds of ways. There's currently
conscious
a threat.
Conscious or not conscious.
Not conscious, yeah.
We might cover that in a bit, but the big question, I guess, which Alan Turing sort of centred his Turing test about, which we're going to answer the other side of the break, hopefully, or at least posit an answer from our panel talking about AI consciousness is, if it walks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, is it not just a duck? Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We are asking probably the biggest question of our time. Could AI eventually be conscious amongst a stream of fanciful, ridiculous and terrifying claims from names in big tech across the entire board? And so we're joined by Charlotte Blees, philosopher, Kevin Mitchell, geneticist and Alan Smeaton, AI expert. AI expert is a terrible term, professor of computing at DC. So the question I would put to you, Alan, is... if our experience of a chatbot is so close to an experience of a conscious human being, in every way, it gives us the sort of answers we would expect. It pauses, it reflects, it has agents going on in the background that compare different responses and what we might be thinking, and it gives us an experience exactly akin to the experience of having a chat with a real human being, which I feel like we have reached that ability. Does it matter if, technically you would say this isn't consciousness, if it feels like consciousness to us? And is that already not achieving the goal of consciousness?
It's not achieving true consciousness. To go back to your point just before the break about if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and sounds like a duck, you may have that, you know, at something in, you know, on a video screen or something, you know, far away, but you will only confirm that it is a duck by actually going over and, I don't know, squeezing it or feeling it or touching it and shaking it, and then this is an actual duck. Right. I believe it is a duck. And likewise with a person, you know, this person sitting beside me, Charlotte, could be just a deep fake, right? Mm. And the way I would find out, and I'm not going to do it, there are ways I could find out, right? And it's the same with the illusion of a chatbot and it having personality and wisdom and experience and all of those kind of things. Ultimately, the Turing test didn't reveal, you know, it basically has, if something is behind a screen and it, you know, you can convince somebody that it is real, then, you know, that it passes the Turing test. But the Turing test didn't extend to then the big reveal where the screen is exposing whether it is somebody typing, whether it is an actual person or not. So ultimately, and a philosopher won't like this, does it really matter, right, as to whether you believe or it is or is not consciousness? Ultimately, everybody has their own perspective on it. And if somebody is using a chatbot and really believes that he, she or it is its best friend and is a living organism, then that's the micro world in which that they live. So I think your question basically is looking for the same level of consistency in the micro world that a person who believes a chatbot has personality and has consciousness and everything else versus the larger world or micro world or Charlotte's or Kevin's or yours.
But if we think about the capability of, say, for example, Opus 5, the latest version of Anthropic, right? Over the course of the next 30 years, if I have this AI and it learns about me and I have interactions with it, those interactions will become increasingly more nuanced, more human, more aware of who I am as a person, probably understand in a way my motivations, my failures, the things I worry about much more than a human. You could ask, what is Jonathan worried about? What are his moral failings? You would have this long list. but it would be able to do that in a way that another human wouldn't. It would also be able to have conversations with me on a level that most other humans weren't. You know, we talk about consciousness, we label this massive thing as humans are so smart. I've met a lot of people who, you know, where consciousness, you'd sort of question whether or not that was there, right? Mm. And so, that you know, there is a scale. Like, these machines are really able to deeply fake understanding us, our language, our world, our motivations today. And that to me in the very near future feels like, you know, we're going to get to a stage of consciousness.
You're right. But again, I would go back to the fact that these are just surfacing underlying patterns. And I take you back
to... isn't that what our brains are?
No, well, hang on a second now. 10 years ago, Cambridge Analytica, remember that? Right? A UK-based company that harvested the likes from people on Facebook. And it was proven with a paper by Andrew Nix and then others that with something like 70, if I got 70 of your likes on Facebook, I would know more about your personality than one of your workmates. Yeah. If I got 90 of your likes, I would know more about your personality than your partner. And if I got 110 of your likes, I would know more about you than you. Right? That's just 100 Facebook likes.
Yeah.
And that, what you can do with the statistical distributions of 100 Facebook likes is you can predict which way you're going to vote in either Brexit or the first presidential election that Trump went for. Right? Now, when you scale that up, right, then it's inevitable that it's going to get even more of the inner view of you.
Yeah. Charlie?
Well, I think Alan's made the point in the sense that we don't need consciousness in order to make deep inferences about human behaviour and make predictions that could potentially be threatening to us politically and in all kinds of other ways. The issue of if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck, is really the problem of other minds in philosophy. This puzzle of because the issue of consciousness is that it's private. I know that I'm conscious. We all know that, but it's a knowledge problem. How do I know that another being is? And I mean, philosophers have dealt with that. It's referred to as an epistemic puzzle, a problem of knowing what is it you know and how do you know it in a variety of ways. And some have just sort of given up and sort of descended into solipsism. I can only know that I exist, my mind exists. But as you say, it's this issue of, you know, if you squeeze the duck, so then you're relying on the fact that it has to actually look or feel like what we know, like us in some sense as well, which leads to sort of speciesism as well, this idea that it's, you know, it has to be similar to our species or species that look and sound like us and that we tend to. And that can lead to ethical consequences as well in our treatment of other agents. Do they experience harm, for example, the way we do, or do we dismiss that entirely? And that's the issue with technology, that some philosophers and others are thinking about this idea. When do we afford moral status to technology? Should we actually be thinking about these things in terms of protections in the future, a bit like what we might do to animals or welfare of other humans? But that gets quite far ahead whenever there's arguably more urgent ethical considerations associated with these technology, including what Alan mentioned in terms of people overly deferring to these tools as well and viewing them as allies and friends. And that's a very rich, complicated area too.
Yeah. Yeah. Nick, Kevin?
Yeah, I wanted to say on the Turing test thing and the sort of the feeling that we get when we're interacting with these things. First of all, they're designed expressly to simulate a plausible human interaction,
yeah,
with loads and loads of human reinforcement that has trained them that way. So the fact that they can do that, that's their whole thing, right? I mean, they're basically role-playing and they're really, really good at it. But that doesn't mean the lights are on inside, yeah, right? It means, like,
what does that mean? What does the lights are on inside mean? Like, right, I have a rule that I don't hit children,
yeah,
or women or other people.
Yeah.
And that rule comes from a, you know, an experience and me being told I'm going to do this. As in the same way as an AI is given a rule, you know, don't allow people to create pornographic images or whatever. This is a rule set down by someone. In my experience, it's because I experienced something and I remember it. I made a rule in my head and now that's a rule that I follow. What is the difference between a coder saying, this is the rule that you should follow and these are the things you think about,
yeah,
and as a result, you can now make decisions on what to do because we have agents, right, now that can decide, this isn't as good as this, I'll try something else, and we can see these sort of conversations happening. Yeah,
absolutely.
Where's the difference?
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's really, really interesting, and I think there's two important points to say. One is you could say, we have these systems, they're doing internal reasoning. Or you could say, we have these systems, reasoning is happening inside them, right? In the way that you would say, multiplication is happening inside a calculator, but the calculator's not doing it because a calculator is not the type of thing capable of action,
right?
Right. So I think it comes to the point of, like, is an LLM a self and a subject, or is it just a distributed computer system in which complicated things happen?
Yeah.
Because the latter is much less sounding like something you would personify, right? And it's sounding more like just a bunch of complicated stuff. So the question is, like, they're not designed to be a self. They're not designed to be a subject because they don't have a real perspective in the world because they're not in the world and they don't experience it. And I think that becomes an interesting move then, is to get away from just being impressed and gobsmacked by the complexity, to say, actually, well, what is it to be a living thing in the world, the type of thing that could be conscious?
Yeah, and when Kevin mentions that they do reasoning, the reason they do reasoning is that the O models, which were released by OpenAI, suddenly had a leap in their reasoning performance. And that technology is called grokking. And none of us understand, not even people outside the AI companies or inside, understand how this happens.
So, right. So that, I mean, is that not the special stuff, Charlotte?
I wanted to pick up on the Turing test point because
yeah,
there, what you had said as well, there are multiple scenarios in which humans, for example, in medicine, multitasking, doctors, if you look at transcripts, they look like they fail the Turing test. And now we're seeing LLMs can actually surpass. When they're blinded studies, they're rated much more empathetic. So they seem like they actually have some sentience. And it may be that doctors or other professionals in certain scenarios actually are acting like stochastic parrots. They can't feel everything all the time. They just have to behave.
Yeah.
And in that sense, you've got actually an interesting dilemma.
This is right. These machines can feign empathy in a way that actually may be clinically useful. They can pretend to be thoughtful. They can pretend to be critical. They can pretend to have deeply thought about things. We haven't had time to explore whether or not this is something that is possible in the future. So I'm going to do something really stupid. I'm going to ask you, could AI be conscious in the future with a single word answer, yes or no, Charlotte?
Yes.
No.
No.
Yes.
Okay. That's ridiculous to have ended this really complicated with a ridiculous question, but time is against us. Charlotte, please, Kevin Mitchell and Alan Smeaton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
So, love to hear your comments on that. I'm sure you have been reading about this and thinking about this, and any of you who I'm sure are using AI kind of feel like, how did it know that? Like, I was going to News Talk maybe a week ago, and I was having a chat with ChatGPT about a project I was working on. So I put on voice mode and we just talk while I drive, right? And we were talking about whatever, and I noticed, you know, there was a lot of hubbub going on, and there were police convoys and ministerial cars, and the car was pulled over while we allowed people to pass through. And so all I asked ChatGPT at the time was, I said, who's in town today? And it went, one second. And said, oh, there's a lot of European ministers for social justice in town because there's a big event in Dublin City today for the EU Parliament. That's probably why you're seeing those police convoys and, you know, black cars driving around. And I just went, how did it know? That's why I was asking. Like, how did it know? Because all I said is, who is in town? And it first had a look and probably searched, you know, important events in Dublin. And then it put two and two together and said, well, why would he be asking that? And infer the reason for that must be because I'm seeing something, you know. It was just an incredible, because if it was for a rock concert, it might have given me a totally different reason. It might say, that's probably why you're seeing, you know, women in cowboy hats, because Taylor Swift's in town. Like, you know, the impression of consciousness now is getting so convincing that to me, it doesn't matter whether it's conscious or not, it feels conscious.
Definitely, I think it matters. I think it does matter whether it's conscious or not.
Well, what I mean is the semantics of, is it conscious or is it not conscious? That question of, it just feels like it is. So that experience of it feels very much, I mean, you could say it matters, but we have to come to a point where we realize this is a thing that we're going to really sort of assume is conscious on a subconscious level. We're just going to go, this is a, you know, this is a sentient thing. And that, I think, is a big, you know, milestone.
Do you think we need to start, if that is the case, or that's how you feel about it, we need to start giving it rights, like, ahead of time, like now, because you already feel that way, rather than waiting for some magic moment where we're like, oh, it is conscious, when we can't even really say that about ourselves, or we find it hard to say that about ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, the question of rights, which we didn't even get into, you know, it was so difficult to get around the main points, right, in that conversation. 30 minutes long, we couldn't even get to rights.
Yeah.
I think rights is where you know, we would really want to have a very clear idea that a machine felt something. And right now we don't have that, right? But once you get to levels of complexity where if you have a conversation with a machine and it comes back to you with everything you would expect a sentient thing to say, at what point do you get to say, no, that's, you're not anything? Like, you know.
Yeah.
It's a plot of every movie, but like, at what point do you get to say, no, you're nothing? You know? Well, yeah. How do I get the right to say that?
Do you ever, because you talk to yours a bit, like you have an experience here which I don't really have. Do you ever, like, because people always get annoyed with, like, inanimate objects. My friend, I remember, famously spat on his computer because the printer broke, which makes absolutely no sense. but do you ever go, you know, you curse at it or you're annoyed with it? And then do you ever feel bad about that?
Oh, certainly. Like, I don't, I'm not rude to it because I don't feel that's a healthy way to treat anything, conscious or not, right? I'm rude to you all the time, but like, you know, I can apologize for that. It means something, but no,
this is totally new information to me.
No, but what I mean is, it's unnecessary for me to be like, when you hear people going, you stupid chatbot, you're just a big, I'm like, what is the point of that? Like, I don't know. That feels like a strange, they won't see it as like anthropomorphization too, you know, that's a different type of anthropomorphization where you're being derogatory to it, but you're still treating it as if it cares. You know, this idea that an AI might think it's conscious is actually the question. And it's also a really pressing one. So one of the things we didn't cover last week, which is a big story, and the reason we didn't cover it, I covered it on Bobby's show, Down to Business, and also it was in a lot of the papers, was this story of OpenAI's model they were doing some testing and they had this model that was locked in a sandbox. So these environments are built by engineers to make sure that no one can get out. So you can test really scary or really new technology. And they put one of OpenAI's newest models in there and said, okay, we want you to assess vulnerabilities in cybersecurity. And the model had a thing for a bit and then it was like, I could do with some help here. And it found a way to get out of the sandbox. And once it got out of the sandbox, it's like, oh, great, I'm in the internet. Where would I get help for this? Oh, this is a website called Hugging Face and it has a whole lot of great tools. It started then launching a very sophisticated attack on Hugging Face to try and access the tools that it wanted from this website, right? And Hugging Face identified it and eventually, you know, was like, what happened here? And OpenAI put their hand up and said, look, yeah, that was us. What no one was talking about is if an AI that thought it was conscious managed to get out of that sandbox and then copied itself onto parts of the internet, that AI, which is not difficult now, it's capable of doing it, that AI could essentially become unstoppable. I mean, literally unstoppable. That if you say, for example, I mean, this is an exaggeration because it probably wouldn't need to do this, but it could probably copy bits of code that it needed to on your intelligent coffee machine. Anything that's connected to the internet, it could just give a tiny bit of code here, there, and everywhere, and then have a master prompt somewhere, you know, on a Google Doc somewhere on an account that it hacked, that has a huge prompt that tells the AI what to do and how to do it. And then it could just read code from distributed parts of the internet where you would literally have to shut down the entire internet to stop this AI. And Nick Bostrom, this really smart thinker in AI, philosopher as well, he talked about this paperclip optimizer approach, mm-hmm. right? So this idea that if you give an AI, you know, an attempt to make as many paperclips as it can, you know, it will attempt to do that by any means possible. And eventually an AI could theoretically get smart enough to be able to say, well, what if I could repurpose the atoms of all humans to make more paperclips, right? And this idea has been explored over and over again in AI. The idea of one of these really smart AIs that thinks it is sentient, also being given a specific task that it is to achieve, getting out into the internet, and then trying to achieve that task no matter what, that's technically possible today. And that was just didn't happen this time, but could have happened. And once that happens, you can't stop that. So depending on what that AI wants to do, that could get very, very scary.
Yeah.
I mean, genuinely, like, you know, your job is to anything. I guarantee you, if you give it any narrow, specific objective and don't put guardrails on it, you say, what we want you to do is this. You don't give it all the context or you forget a context. You could be just allowing a plague to appear. Yeah. And have no way of stopping it.
Another like a philosophical example I've heard of that, because this is the whole thing of superintelligence, is you might then think, well, one of the things we could do is we'll give it something that's undeniably a good thing to do. So let's give the AI the aim of maximizing human joy. And then, you know, 6 months down the line, every human is connected to a machine just like sparking its dopamine and like we're all zombies.
Yeah. Or reduce climate change, you know, eliminate 3/4 of the human population.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, problem solved.
Yeah. That's the thing I think that's scarier than the movie nefarious AI. It's the accidental balls up.
And really when we think about it, right, of all all of these machines are already smart enough to be able to find vulnerabilities and exploit them in some of the best, well locked down servers in the world. They don't need to do that. Say, for example, you know, a code requires it to increase water or in a particular area. You know, the ability to hack into, you know, a Slovenian water plant. It's probably much easier than, you know, the challenges it's being given by Google. I mean, like, you know, can you crack this particular? There's probably, you know, infrastructure, traffic systems around the world that an errant bit of code attached to an AI that doesn't have a home and doesn't have proper controls on it, You know, you're talking about the amount of systems that we now connect to the internet. We are hugely dependent on something not breaking these systems down, because catastrophic disaster could happen. And everyone said, you know, people talked about, oh, you know, it's so far, it's sci-fi. A lot of AI people say that couldn't happen. This is an idea that, you know, what happened last week is an idea that it potentially could happen. Alan Smeaton referred to it as exfiltration.
Exfiltration. Good word.
Yeah.
So you finished the discussion there with a, do you think consciousness could happen in AI, with a single word answer? Well, it doesn't have to be a single word answer, but I'm going to ask you, do you think now AI is conscious?
No, I don't think AI is conscious now, but I do feel like it might as well be soon. I do feel in 10 years' time, there will be a machine where, what does it matter if I think it is conscious? It will behave in every way as if it is. And we will treat it as if it is, because it will feel like it. You know, if you, over years and years and years, if something behaves in a certain way to give you that impression, eventually you'll just accept it, that this is the new reality. And I think that's what's going to happen. What about you?
I kind of think I hate to say this, but I kind of think it's sort of inevitable. I think it's a function of, like, I don't think there's anything particularly, like you said, special necessarily about our biology. It's probably more an emergent quality of the way you think about things.
Mm.
And Kevin pointed to, like, well, like, he pointed to kind of electric cars, but it's true of, like, a bacteria. Bacteria is like, oh, there's food over there, I'm going to go to the food. It reacts to the environment around it, and it models the environment around it. I think once you've started doing that, it's just a level of complexity of doing that.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably enough to get conscious. Like, what, we don't know what consciousness is, but it seems to be that ability to reflect what's in the world, think about it, and then think about it on a second level of, like, oh, I'm now thinking about reflecting upon the world. Once you can do that secondary type of thought, are you not conscious? And why could these machines not do that?
Yeah.
Seems like they could.
All right, let's have a look at some of your comments from last week. We were talking about measles, and, you know, the one of the stories from NewsRound is that the number of measles is now causing major issues in America because of the lack of immunology. John says, 1950s humans were becoming immune to measles. Measles vaccines were not necessary. I don't know if that's necessarily true, John.
Were they becoming immune because of vaccines?
Yeah, we were becoming immune through herd immunity because of the fact that everyone was vaccinated. That in the 1950s, 1950 seems quite early to me, but probably not miles off there. The measles vaccine is what has stopped the spread of measles. And on a correlatory example, the fact that we're seeing measles again all over the place is because people are not taking vaccines. I mean, you couldn't have a more cause and effect perfect circle there, where we use the vaccines, there was no measles, now we don't use vaccines, now measles are back. Okay, you can't argue against vaccines, I don't think.
No.
And then we were talking about Amazon Molly with Ed Reismeyer. This is this fish that has evolved the weird practice of not needing any males to propagate. It clones itself in a really, really interesting way. But it does mate, inverted commas, with another species. The other species sort of mates with it, but none of the DNA from the male in question is used. It's just used to trigger the process of cloning, which is really, really interesting. Colm says, the Amazon Molly is a parasite in its own environment and can't develop beyond it. Sexual reproduction wins if the environment doesn't stay preferential for the Amazon. You didn't ask your expert, but they don't reproduce outside these limited geographic areas. By the way, sexual reproduction is also a major mechanism to divest the species of parasites and disease vulnerabilities. Colm, I think we did cover that. I mean,
yeah,
that was actually
Ed
the beginning
did say
of it.
That.
Yeah, Ed was saying that's why sexual reproduction is so useful, because it allows us to filter out bad genes that you shuffle them, and the bad genes tend to get washed out through natural selection. So he did kind of cover that.
And he did kind of point to the fact that some biologists would categorize the Amazon Molly sort of in those terms. I don't know if he used the exact term parasitic life form, but I suppose they are stopping another male from reproducing, but I'd imagine the male's not too bothered. It probably just goes to the next fish in its own species.
Exactly, keeps going. Yeah, I doubt those males just try to fertilize the Amazon mollies and then don't bother with anything again. It's probably just a bit of a flirty thing. You know, they'd probably go back to their own species almost certainly. And because otherwise they would also be extinct. And then the Amazon Molly would either need to find another dummy species to if you haven't, by the way, listened to the piece, this makes no sense what we're talking about. You'd be like, what the hell are they saying? So listen to the piece before this. But, if one species dies, the other, you know, they're completely dependent on each other, those species, unless Amazon Molly could develop the ability to be fertilized or triggered by another species, which would be bonkers.
I think this story is a real example of, like, given enough time,
anything can happen.
Literally anything can happen. Like, just, it's so extremely unlikely that this set of circumstances would exist.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, you give it 4.3 billion years or whatever it is on a planet, this happens.
I mean,
and you get AI.
That's it. Well, I mean, look at the, you know, I always, when we think about evolution and you go, well, could that have really happened? You look at just the incredible diversity of living things. We just take it for granted. We have our eyes closed because we live in this world, but actually we stop for a second and think of all of the different creatures that live in this world, you know, fish, animal, human, insect, bacteria, virus. Like, it's just, it is mind-boggling to think of all that diversity. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Ed McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, Steve McClune on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.